Make It Right, the manufacturing podcast.
This is the Make It Right podcast. I'm Janet Eastman, and today Kevin Snook joins us from Bangkok. Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Hi, Janet. Very well. Thank you.
I hear you had a bit of a race to get to our call today. Tell us a little bit about your traffic issue.
Well, Bangkok's always interesting with traffic. I was on my way to the podcast and the taxi got stuck. So I was out of the taxi and onto a motorbike. But all here okay. Heart racing a little bit, but I'm in good shape.
You sound a bit like Tom Cruise to me at this point in time. But anyway, let's move forward here. It's been a few weeks since we last spoke. Has anything actually really interesting happened to you when you've been doing your factory tours in the last little while that you saw that you thought, oh, let's talk about this for a second?
There's been a few things. There's been a lot of conversations come up around artificial intelligence. And one big part of that is there's a lot of fear behind, you know, AI and whether everyone's going to be losing their jobs to artificial intelligence and robotics. And I do some work in South Korea, and that's actually the country that has the highest level of robotics in the world. And so there's a lot of discussion around there, around what's happening in the future. But I think we've still got a long way to go before people are going to be losing their jobs to robots.
So that basically what you're saying is that the manufacturing employee at this point in time doesn't really have anything to fear from AI.
You know, I thought that originally. And as I've talked to more people and I've looked at more statistics and things around this subject, I think it actually breaks up differently into different parts of the world. And what's happening over in places like the US and to some extent in South Korea, Japan, places with a higher overall GDP, is that people are losing manufacturing jobs and AI is taking, or AI, robotics, et cetera, is taking a big role on the factory floor. Now, those jobs are not disappearing from the world, though. What's happening is that other countries are catching up and are, you know, employing more people in manufacturing at a relatively high level of skill in manufacturing. And so overall, globally, you know, there's still plenty of jobs, but certainly jobs are shifting in the higher GDP countries to countries that are, if you like, developing more.
So if you are a manufacturing employee in one of these countries where you see this happening, what's your next step? Like, are there other jobs in manufacturing that you can skill up to?
Well, there's certainly, I think there is always a role for people that are willing to skill up, willing to change and to grow their skills. And that's not only in the, you know, the more developed countries, that's also around the world. I've never seen a shortage of people that are highly skilled. And so I think the key for people in those countries is to continue learning, learn how to make AI your friend, rather than be afraid of it. And to do that, you know, you really have to be looking less at the mechanical skills and more at the electrical skills, less at the purely operational skills and more at the creative or innovative skills. And so, and I think there's a big role for companies to play here. I think companies need to be looking at this, seeing it happening, and upskilling their teams themselves.
So for the average factory that is really going in this automation direction, what impact is that going to have on their staff levels? Is it going to cut staff in half? What's it going to do?
Yeah, so if I take an example of, say, 20, 25 years ago when I was working in England, in the UK, one baby diaper production line was running with, you know, four or five people to run that one production line. Now that same company is running the line twice as fast, so making, you know, twice as many products per minute, and running with one person on the production line rather than four or five. So the overall number of people has come down significantly. Now, in order to do that, the skill of that individual has to be significantly higher. What is happening, though, is that people are leaving manufacturing to some extent in countries like the US and the UK and going into service parts. And so that might be service in the same company. If you have a company that's a consumer goods company, you may be moving into sales or into marketing or into some of the new roles, social media roles that have been created. But yes, factory floors are, the number of staff on a factory floor in a highly developed country is certainly reducing.
Right. So if you have all this machinery that is basically operating on its own and you have one person overseeing it and something goes wrong, then what happens?
Yeah, and this is where a lot of companies are getting caught in the middle. The more highly developed companies, if you look at a Toyota or a Procter & Gamble or someone who's invested a huge amount of money in robotics, they have systems in place that will pick up the pieces relatively quickly. So if something goes wrong, part of the automation will help solve the problem. They'll have a staff where people can move from one line onto the other line to help get it going again. Now, there's a whole load of companies that are caught in the middle on this kind of AI revolution, if you like. And they're the ones who can't afford to go fully robotic. Robotic solutions are incredibly expensive. There's a huge amount of capital involved in getting to that point. And so at that stage, you can't afford to suddenly jump into that. What you do is you start getting used to it. You start getting used to building the skill of your team and making sure that the team is using a certain level of AI or robotics to help them do their manual jobs. And so, yes, in the companies that can afford to go from four or five people running a highly sophisticated line to one, they're going to need to have help from other parts of the organization if that line stops. In other companies, the key is how do I gradually move into understanding more about this higher tech without getting caught in that mid-ground and either being swamped by the bigger companies or being swamped by the guys that are just staying manual and not willing to move forward in some sort of automation.
Yeah, I guess when you decide to go in this direction, you can't just drop everything and implement it all because, as you say, there's a cost factor there. So do you start with one line or one part of a bunch of lines and get everybody up to speed on that? Like, how do you roll this out?
Yeah, I always recommend in any type of project like this, starting small and getting some wins and some successes. You have to do things significantly different, and you don't want to go with the whole organization at once. Otherwise, it just becomes way too complex. I've worked on projects before where I've made this mistake, where I've thought that somebody can upskill the whole factory at a certain time. And even encourage them to go in that direction to realize that I'd made a mistake and they really couldn't handle that complexity. And at that point, people tend to regress back to very basic systems and almost bypass the new technology. So I'm very sensitive to that now. I think I made the first mistake on that about 15 years ago and learned pretty quickly from that the best way to do it, start small, start on one line or a pair of lines. Make sure that the systems are in place to be able to support the new technology and the people growth on that area. Get a few wins, start to build some confidence in the organization, and then have a rollout plan to step that through the organization over a period of time.
And where does the real-time data come in on all of this? It goes in on these new lines and tells you where the problems are that you might encounter, correct?
Yeah, well, real-time data is just information, right? And in order to make informed decisions, you need great information. And in order to make quick decisions, decisions now, you need real-time information. And so the key is to make sure that whatever information system you put in place, the information is giving people immediately the information they need in order to make a good decision. So you need to get that started. You need to start with the frontline employees because they're the ones who are actually making the decisions every minute of the day that make the difference on the business. And so you want a system that's going to give the frontline employees real-time information on the front line in order to be able to take decisions. And then you need a system that's also going to give the managers or the leadership team the information to see what's been happening and see where people need significant help and support.
So when you have this real-time data, how, drill down just a little bit for me. If we have this, one of these big lines that is pretty much to the point where it's fully automated, you have that one person watching the screen and watching the line, making sure everything goes. Is that real-time data going to say something like, okay, you've got a little bit of a loose part over here and it's just started to get loose. Let's address that right now. Can it drill down that deeply?
So on some of these systems certainly can. You know, we're doing remote vibration monitoring, different sort of remote sensoring to be able to pick up items like that. Now, on the highly sophisticated machines, what's actually happening is there's a robotic feedback loop. And so the machine will get some information. It'll say something's going wrong, but then the machine itself will learn from that and then put a fix in place. So you actually don't need a human in that loop. But as I said before, most companies can't afford that kind of automatic feedback system. So what they're doing is taking information from the production line that's coming in real-time data, then showing that to a human, and the human then says, hey, look, I see what's going on. And in many cases, the AI system is also prompting an action, and then the human goes in and takes that action rather than the automatic feedback system. And so most companies that can't afford the highly robotic, highly automated systems are using something in between. And so that's information directly from the machine in real time, directly to the operators in real time and to the leadership team in real time. But then there's a human intervention to make some kind of improvement.
So if you're using this real-time data and you see all this and you can make those changes, that's perfect. If you're not using the real-time data, how long can the machine be running making these minor, well, with these minor issues happening before the person on the line finally goes, oh, the product doesn't look right at all? Like, yeah. How much can actually be wasted and how long would it run before somebody actually realized there was a problem?
Yeah, and it's normally a combination of problems along the line that creates the quality the quality issue. And in my experience, once you get the quality issue, it's too late. First of all, it's expensive in terms of scrap and rejects. But more than that, the line is already out of control. It's already telling you what has to be done. You know, it's forcing you to make a decision. What you want to be doing before that is picking up small defects, minor defects that haven't yet given you a quality defect. You know, it might be a bearing that needs oiling. It might be one of the sensors that keeps the materials on the right track is just getting a bit dirty. You want to know that before it gives you a quality issue. And that's where these automatic systems with direct feedback to the operators will help you to take care of the issues before you get any scrap or any rejects.
Okay, so when we're talking about quality, I've always had this question. What is the difference between quality control and quality assurance? Are they two different departments? Are they two different pursuits? Like, what's the difference here?
That's a great question. It's typically quality control. If you like, quality control is the older system. It's where you find defects that have already happened. So some people call it quality control. Some people call QC quality checking. But really, it's checking product and then finding out what percentage of that product is defective and then trying to stop that defective product that's already been made going to the consumer. Now, quality assurance is a proactive process. So quality assurance is all about putting the systems in place, putting the environment in place to prevent the causes of potential defects. And so there's this very difference. One is reactive, and that's quality control or quality checking. The other one is preventive or proactive, which is the quality assurance.
So are these two different departments or are they one big department?
In most companies, they're one big department with quality control or quality checking, a part of a program that is managed by a quality assurance group.
Okay.
So there would be a lot of other parts of that program as well. So, for example, in a company that's been doing this for some time, there'd be many elements of this quality assurance program. And for example, leadership would be one part. Is the leadership reacting and responding and taking quality seriously? Another part might be laboratory controls. You know, is our laboratory or the place where we check the products, is that set up effectively? And is equipment in there properly maintained and looked after? And so there's many different elements of a quality assurance program that are preventing defects from happening. Quality control is one part of that, which is doing checks to make sure that the quality assurance program is working.
Okay. So is this what world-leading manufacturing companies are doing? Is that their process or how do they go about it?
Yeah, so they have what we call quality assurance capability or some way of measuring the level of confidence that defects will not be made on that production line. And that can, as I said, there's many different elements to that. I'll give you a few more examples. One might be pest control. So how is the environment set up so that flies and insects and other problems can't get into the product? Another area would be process control. So how well is the operating department managing the process within capability limits so that there's a lower percentage chance of products, you know, having a defect. And so, that's exactly what the world-class companies are doing. They're working almost 100% on preventing defects from happening rather than catching and responding to defects happening.
Right, because that's the better way to save money, I guess.
Yeah, and people tend to think that there's an upfront cost to this, and there is a little bit. But once you start taking quality seriously and you get your equipment set up well, you have good cleaning and, you know, cleaning and maintenance procedures in place, you set the environment so there's no insects and et cetera. Once you get those programs in place, then actually the costs related to quality come down significantly. So there is, it's like most things, there is a little bit of an upfront investment. There's certainly an investment in training the teams and putting new systems in place. But once you have that in place, then it's actually a lower cost to maintain a higher quality plant rather than trying to get through with a lower quality plant.
So basically it's preventative medicine.
Yes, it is. It is. It's actually preventative. So it's all about that. It's all about stopping the problem from happening. And you know that even with healthcare, you know, exactly as you were mentioning, it's about wellness, not about fixing sickness. And if we can keep ourselves fit and healthy, then our medicine bills, our doctor's bills, you know, go down significantly. But you have to have a little bit of, you have to know what to do. And then you have to have a bit of discipline to put those systems in place to keep your body fit and healthy so you don't have to go to the doctor as often. And that's exactly the same in a manufacturing facility.
So is there actually a structured way to improve quality? Is there like an ISO system that people use?
Yeah, some people use ISO, and that is one way to move forward. One of the challenges with ISO is we tend to measure whatever your process is, they are checking whether you're putting your process in place. It's not necessarily checking whether your process works. So most companies need to find a system, and there are some good models here that can be reapplied throughout the world. They need to find a system that works specifically for their factory or for their type of business. And there's some, you know, there's definitely some templates to follow for companies that that need to do this. But it starts off with looking at all the different possible causes of quality issues, looking at which ones are the current priorities based on current performance, and then starting to knock those off one at a time in a way that complements the process, complements the people in the business.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin. I think we're out of time, but next time when we speak, we're going to talk about how to manage consumer or customer complaints. So we've talked about quality, then we'll find out how to get make sure we've got the right quality so we can avoid those consumer and customer complaints. Thanks very much for chatting with me today.
Thank you, Janet.
So you can find the Make It Right podcast on iTunes and at lucidi4.com, Make It Right. And we hope you'll share it with your colleagues, and we'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening.